Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
You have the demographic imbalances, which is, in the last couple of hundred years, one of the, particularly the late 20th century, is the most significant by far driver of human mobility and migration, right? Is simply the search for economic opportunity in countries where there are labor shortages and higher wages. And that explains literally most of late 20th century migration. So we ought to be relatively familiar with it. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's still pernicious inequality in the world and still plenty of people who seek opportunity. And the labor shortages in advanced industrial OECD countries are only getting worse as our populations age and our fertility declines. So on and on it goes, right? So every single driver that you could identify, every cluster of variables that pushes and shapes our human geography over the last 100,000 years is in overdrive. And yes, we've had a lockdown. But you tell me, is the map of human geography actually frozen in time because of this lockdown? And the answer is, of course not.
Got a excellent episode for you. For the crew of people who thought we were a little too unskeptical of the discussion on China, everyone is going to be very happy with this one. We have Parag Khanna. He is the author of Move, The Forces Uprooting Us, and The Future is Asian. This is a great conversation because it speaks to the themes that Sagar and I are really obsessed with, aka what happens to a world that is changing in ways that we don't even understand. Parag's most two recent books, Move, which just came out last week, and then The Future is Asian, are basically dealing with this, the following argument. How will the 21st century change when the majority of economic and military power is in Asia? And what happens when, after the COVID pause, as we discussed during the episode, you see all of this mass migration, geographic location, both like within Western states, with people on the southern border of the United States, Africans moving to Europe, all those forces, lots of great stuff, which probably we disagree about. But Sagar, I think there's still something that really comes from this. And that's why he was a great guest.
Yeah, I really enjoy talking to Parag. Parag is almost a polar opposite, kind of, in my opinion, but in the most useful, good faith and productive way. So we have really big debates about childcare, about immigration, about the nation state, about what America means, about the West, about Asia, where it's all going, how we should handle it. I think it's pretty spirited. For anybody who thinks we're neoliberal shills, well, I would just point you to this episode in particular and the pushback that Marshall and I try to give in terms of representing all the different points of view that we can. I think people are going to get a lot out of it. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah. And once again, like, Parag went to high school in Germany. He lives in Singapore. We're bringing a different perspective here. And once again, we're not going to agree on 90% of what he says here, but the frame, AKA what happens when people try to move a lot and what happens with a global economic GDP shift are really important ones. And it's up to you as an audience to figure out like where you stand on it. Before we get into the episode, a few quick notes, especially for the new listeners. We have a Realignment Substack that goes out every Thursday afternoon Eastern Standard Time. You can follow the link that is in the show notes to go to therealignment.substack.com. Original content, episodes of the week, bonus materials, lots of great stuff there. You really enjoy it. We love getting people there, especially as we're continuing to do more audience response. Secondly, this is an episode discussing someone's book. Parag's books are available at our bookshop. If you purchase a book at our bookshop link that is also contained within the show notes, you not only help support a local bookseller, the author who has given us a generous amount of his time on the show, but you also help get The Realignment 10% of any sales. So you could obviously go to Amazon to get your books as well, but we think Bookshop is an amazing first choice for all of you. And you could also follow the links in the bookshop storefront as well too. You have the books that Sagar and I are reading, all the books by previous guests. We've actually really built a great library that we know everyone will get a kick off of. Last but not least, we are about to head out to Miami for the Realignment Conference. So we're super pumped for that. If you are going to be there, hit us up. If you live in Miami and aren't going to the conference, hit us up anyways. It's really exciting. We've very publicly been having a crazy time in the past few months with Breaking Points, organizing a conference in person, not just over the internet. By the way, it's very hard. Don't just do that by default. Zoom actually gets quite a bit done for you. But we're glad to be back to normal. After next week, we'll be doing dual episodes more. We'll be putting out new stuff and having just a great time with the opportunity to take the show to a higher level. So thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get into the episode. Parag Khanna, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you guys.
I'm excited to talk with you because you're making an argument about mobility and migration that seems to, at least from a narrative perspective, come at the absolute worst time, in the sense that we are still in the middle of slash coming out of COVID, whereas you write in the book, everyone effectively had to go home, borders shut. And then on a deeper level, and we've talked about this since the start of the show, you've had a period, especially in Western politics, where whether it's Brexit, the European Union, the US-Mexico border with Donald Trump, where you've had our politics be defined by a populist backlash against migration. So just at a narrative level, why are you making a pro-global migration argument right now?
It's great place to start. So first of all, thank you guys for having me on. I love seeing the next generation seize the reins here in shaping the narrative. And you guys are definitely younger than me, or at least you look it. So this is a special pleasure. So first of all, yes, it seems paradoxical, not necessarily the worst moment, but a paradoxical moment, or I should say a seemingly paradoxical moment. I'll get into why. To be doing a book like this, because the world has just experienced the most unprecedented coordinated simultaneous lockdown, the most coordinated act in the history of the world was this lockdown, which would seem to speak exactly against, you know, diametrically opposed to my argument. But bear in mind, actually, I finished the book before COVID, so I've actually had time to update it and to include COVID. And the fact is that just because COVID happened, the lockdown happened, doesn't really undermine any of the fundamental drivers that shape our human geography, which is to say our distribution around the world and to change that distribution. So again, I've just made one important nuance. You raised the question about migration. This is a book about human geography. Migration is an important topic that is a very significant subset of human geography. But human geography, as I point out, is more like climatology, whereas migration is like meteorology, right? It's the day-to-day question about, you know, how many people cross which borders in which year. But the deep science of human geography doesn't stop evolving just because there was a pandemic and even an unprecedented lockdown. Especially when you take that big step back, which you always should do when you're writing a book that's meant to have a shelf life, and talking about something that has 100,000 years of history and a long way ahead also, you look back, you step back and you say, what are the forces that compel people to shift their location? Simple as that, right? And the answers are, historically, climate, right? We live where we do right now at this moment because of the latitudes that are considered the optimal climate niche. And they have been that niche for the last 10 to 12,000 years, relatively stable. And that's why you are where you are. And that niche is shifting, so you will move, right? Because everything that comes with that resource shift, that niche shift includes depletion of resources like water, you know, groundwater supply, arable land, agriculture, rising sea levels, all of the environmental forces. And that's just one thing. Now, that hasn't been a huge driver of human migration in the last like 500 years. So we don't think about it. But now let me pose the rhetorical question. Did the pandemic lockdown end climate change? Well, no, it didn't. Right. Secondly, there's political crises, of course, and it could be the expulsions, genocides, civil wars, international conflicts of the past. And those also have not stopped because, oh, wait, hold on. We've got to handle COVID. Right. The Afghan refugee crisis is accelerating. The Syrian crisis continues to unfold and on and on and on. You have the demographic imbalances, which is in the last couple of hundred years, one of the, particularly the late 20th century, is the most significant by far. Driver of human mobility and migration, right, is simply the search for economic opportunity in countries where there are labor shortages and higher wages. And that explains literally most of late 20th century migration. So we ought to be relatively familiar with it. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's still pernicious inequality in the world and still plenty of people who seek opportunity. And the labor shortages in advanced industrial OECD countries are only getting worse as our populations age and our fertility declines. So on and on it goes, right? So every single driver that you could identify, every cluster of variables that pushes and shapes our human geography over the last 100,000 years is in overdrive. And yes, we've had a lockdown. But you tell me, is the map of human geography actually frozen in time because of this lockdown? And the answer is, of course not. So I feel perfectly justified having done this book before, during, or after COVID, because it is ultimately just a blip. And the to your second point, I don't want to drone on, sorry.
No, it's great.
On the point about the politics, most human migration isn't really, you know, the barbarians at the gate, you know, as some might say, very crudely, of course, of them to us, right? In the sense that Western politics is not the barometer to be using. And even if you were using the barometer, it would be a perfect example of the disconnect between our discourse and reality. Because as we know from the US Census that was just published in last month, and the data sets are coming out as we speak, American society became more diverse, more Latino, more mixed race, all under Trump's nose. And Biden wants to give this pathway towards citizenship to undocumented migrants. He wants to expand the H-1B quota and all of these other things. So 10 years from now, we will look back when, from a demographic standpoint, not from the standpoint of our politics and polarization, obviously, from a demographic standpoint, we'll look back and we will say Trump who? And you can actually today say Brexit what? Because they have a trucker shortage, 100,000 person shortage of truckers right now. They're being told they will not have hot food at Christmas because of their gas and food shortages. And it's entirely because their Brexit immigration policy was so messed up. And now they're desperate to import people like nobody's business. Germany has just had an election. And of course, the right-wing parties that threatened to overturn the political consensus and the centrist kind of coalition that has held for a long time, were wiped off the map, which is utterly unsurprising if you know anything about German politics. So where is that anti-immigration right wing today in Germany, which is a very important immigrant society today? And then there's Canada, which has just had an election as well and has been unwavering in its commitment to increase its population by 1% every year, which means 400,000 people a year. So the most important Western societies in the end have turned back to the path that they've been on for decades, which is to continue as mass migration societies. So the fundamental drivers and today's realities, despite populist politics, all point in the direction of a continuous, ceaseless expansion of a new distribution, you know, of human geography.
It's really interesting because you can look at it exactly two ways whenever it comes to that question. You can look at it as inevitable. And yes, it is certainly true the Biden administration came in, but you can also see that, you know, significant disapproval. You could easily see a world where the Trump could easily be reelected in 2024 or some sort of Trumpist like candidate who, if anything, would be more competent in putting a restriction immigration policy in. Brexit is a similar one. So I'm not quite sure. I do know that the shortages are coming with the trucks, that it is causing some political consternation in Britain. And yet there does not yet, at least from what I can tell, be like a big driver of political backlash to the original idea itself. It's more that people think the entire implementation is a mess. So when we're looking at the sweeping declaration that these Western societies are going to be more open, could it not actually be the converse, that the increased mobility, migration, especially as you talk about in the book, movement from the global south to the north, that could actually fuel and create societies which, if anything, become more hardened over time, kind of your classic sci-fi, right? Elysium at the most, you know, extreme end of the spectrum, Children of Men, those types of things.
So, I mean, two things. First of all, it's a book of scenarios, right? So I don't make a prediction that you will have a frictionless path towards the continuous circulation of billions of people around the world into stable habitats, and it will all be peaceful and sustainable. That's one of four scenarios in the book. It's the one that is easy to fixate on because it's the least realistic and but also normatively the most bold. And obviously, yeah, you know, I do wear it on my sleeve that I would like to see that happen for the sake of the sustenance of mankind, and the kind of the survivability of our human species kind of rests in some ways on us actually doing that. So when I put it in those terms, it's not really about, well, your opinion is naive and my opinion is, you know, conservative and grave and status quo, and therefore we just can't get along. I'm talking about something that's a bit more fundamental, and you and I can both agree that when you're talking about the context of a world population plateau and decline that is going to happen anyway, which could be seen as a good thing for the environment, mentalities can shift at two levels. The macro level mentality shift is, wait a minute, we don't really need to fear global overpopulation. Nothing of the sort is happening. You know, people predicted just 20 years ago that the world population would reach 15 billion people, and it's not going to be anywhere near that. And again, this is a point I pick apart in the book. I doubt we'll reach 9 billion people, right? So when you talk to a Brexiteer or, you know, a neo-Nazi, whatever the case may be, say, just hold on a minute. The world population is literally not going to reach 9 billion people. There isn't going to be an endless stream of, you know, deprived, malnourished, you know, people overwhelming your society. We're actually dealing with a global population decline. And now we actually have some kind of collective duty, again, to maintain the human species by way of doing some degree of, you know, resettlement so that we can control our decline. And suddenly there's something bigger than you know, just you and me and our local national, you know, kind of politics. And then the second thing is, you know, you're in a way, when you say that in 2024, you could have Trump again or someone like him, or, you know, Boris Johnson doesn't seem to be threatened. Well, that's kind of like a man makes the moment argument rather than moment makes the man. Because the fact is that as Western societies realize that they have reached a demographic plateau and are actually in decline, if not for more migration, when they see the labor shortages resulting in the supply chain, you know, disruptions and there's this lack of fundamental services being provided, the trash doesn't get picked up in Italy, the trucks don't deliver food in England, and, you know, in America, our mothers and fathers have died alone in nursing homes during COVID because we didn't have enough nurses. And so it was during COVID and during the Trump administration that U.S. embassies and consulates all over the world were open despite the lockdown orders. And their number one job was to recruit anyone with any kind of nursing background or any relevant skill set to the healthcare industry to buy them one-way tickets to fly to America to take care of us while we were dying. So even under the Trump administration, you did have that. Secondly, you had Mick Mulvaney, whom I quote in the book during his time as either chief of staff or head of the OMB, where he said, "We are desperate, desperate, desperate." You remember this quote from the Washington mm-hmm. Post. "We are desperate, desperate, desperate for more people. Our economy will shrink by $1 trillion by the year 2030 if we don't go back to the path of significant migration." So, you know, I'm not sort of, you know, if a Democrat or Republican comes into office in 2024, be that as it may, I'm going to put my money on I'm going to wager that it'll be a similar dynamic in the end to what happened under Trump, which is you continue to have significant inward migration into the United States because you actually need it from a demographic and economic point of view. So supply and demand is, you know, a truly overwhelming force at some level. And, you know, politics, knee-jerk, you know, populism is nothing but a blip in comparison to the power of supply and demand.
You know, what's really interesting? You kind of said two different things there. So when you were talking about the COVID era, home health aid, nursing home worker one, put aside the point you're making about Brexiteers and neo-Nazis, because I do think we could posit that there are plenty of, let's say, even moderate conservative people who are opposed to the type of immigration policies you're describing. It doesn't have to solely be framed in racial terms. But I really struggle to see people objecting to the specific case you just made around embassies, which is why the Trump administration pursued that policy. We need nurses. We need home health aides. That's a very clear interest-driven argument that politicians of either party would largely be comfortable making. But earlier in what you were saying, you said the following. You referred to a global responsibility to resettle migrants, displaced persons, refugees, etc. And those are two entirely different cases. And I think what Sagar and I will agree on is that the case, the economic case you made around declining populations and workers, is entirely separate from the migration-based one. So I think most Americans would see a difference between the Haitian migrant crisis on the border and, once again, people walking into legal embassies during COVID. So can you, and I think that the political factors are going to be driven by the Haitian style example and not the example with the embassies. So let's put these two cases aside for a second. I would like you to sort of explain the differences between these two situations and how you think they play out at a political but also socioeconomic level.
They are night and day, other than that they involve people crossing a border and, you know, seeking legal domicile inside the United States or any other country for that matter. And so I want to play along with you in this because I think you're absolutely right to make sure that we keep these things separate. And on both, though, a lot of reform is needed. When it comes to the legal skilled migration, if you look at the alphabet soup, right, of immigration in the United States, as you well know, it's enough to, you know, make, you know, just does your head in, and it deters people because the talented people will just follow a points-based system like Canada's, go online and say, you know what, I'd rather just be a nurse in Canada, right? Or I'd rather do my IT, you know, studies or work for a tech company in Canada at this point, because it's more transparent and my pathway to citizenship begins, you know, the day my plane lands. So we do have to be careful that there is actually competition for skilled migrants, and we are still destination number one, but it used to be much more of a clear cut, you know, sort of dominance of the field in basically every sector. And it just isn't anymore. And the numbers bear that out very clearly in terms of where talented students and professionals and various, you know, categories are going. So it's worthy of a, you know, broader discussion, but in general, again, the U.S. is actually going in the right direction. If you look at what Biden wants to do with H-1Bs and all of this kind of stuff. So let's talk about then, you know, this sort of, you know, unskilled migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, and so on. Now, let's bear in mind that here, too, the U.S. has been very generous, if only by necessity. If you look at the natural disasters that have afflicted the Caribbean islands, if you look at everything from the earthquake in Haiti over a decade ago to the current disaster that's unfolded there, and then the hurricanes in, I think it was the Bahamas, Puerto Rico, hundreds of thousands of people from those countries and those islands and territories have flooded into the United States, you know, starting their journey in Florida usually and then making their way around over the last few years, right? It's already happened. It's not like they were kept away. And, you know, it's worth a brief comparison to Europe, where, as you well know, the Greeks and Italians take machine guns and shoot at the rafts of African and Arab migrants coming across the Mediterranean, right? So whatever imagery we see on the Rio Grande is not as horrific. I mean, I'd rather that we not have to compare how horrific these scenes are, but, you know, ours is ever so slightly more humane than what you see happening in Europe right now, which is not to say I'm patting us on the back. I appreciate the dilemma that Washington is in terms of wanting to encourage only legal migration and therefore flying Kamala Harris down to Guatemala to say, look, you have to apply here, you know, and we're not just going to let you in. We need to have an orderly process. And remember that if we were to get that orderly process right, the problem is that we're building the plane while flying it because there are these refugee crises right now unfolding, right? If there were a moment of pause or calm, then maybe we could finish that plane and have it be a plane that's fit for purpose. But we're building it while flying, which is why it's a bit of a mess. And so we're stopping all of these people from coming in from Mexico. And a migrant crisis, or the non-migrant crisis for us, because we're not letting these people in, is still a migrant crisis for someone, by the way, and it's a country called Mexico, right? And now there's 3 to 4 million people in Mexico that they can't handle, and they certainly don't have our capacity to handle. And the instability that may unfold in Mexico as a result of this is obviously going to have consequences for us, because Mexico is now, we trade more with Mexico than we do with China. We trade more with Canada than we do with China. So what happens there matters, and we have to view these things in a holistic way, not just about a question of, okay, who's more humanitarian and generous, me or you, right? This actually has consequences for political stability, for trade relations, and a whole bunch of other things. But can we, in terms of our territory, can we absorb, you know, millions more people? Of course we can. You know, that's hardly the difficulty, right? Logistics is not exactly the problem here. It's about the politics. And I don't think we're going to resolve the politics unless we have that broader conversation about cost-benefit analysis and an honest conversation about what labor we do need, even unskilled labor, by the way. And I don't think that should be off the table as something that is, presumed to be negative, right? Because actually a lot of research shows that it's also contributes vitally to the economy. I use the example in the book of, babysitters and cleaning ladies and maids and so forth, and tie that to the motherhood penalty during COVID. And looking at all the women who have dropped out of the workforce because they don't have any help at home for cooking, for cleaning, for childcare, which is unskilled work that women from Latin America or anywhere else can do. And I give the comparison to other countries that have a high degree of unskilled immigration in that exactly those sectors. And those women don't have to make professional sacrifices. So you can't at the same time believe that women have an equal place in society and then force them to be the ones who are at home with the children during a COVID lockdown and sacrifice their careers. Because the fact is there's a one word solution to that dilemma, and it's called migration.
Right. But then the other side of the coin is you could just have a redistributive welfare state to make it so that they don't have to make... They can either make the choice if they want to, or they can be paid simply in order to take time off. I'm not saying this is just women, there's men too. I mean, anybody who wants to do it.
But we're doing neither.
I agree. I think it's a travesty.
And, you know, you could look at Sweden and you could look at France. Yeah. You could say, okay, they have incredibly generous welfare states. So women get very long maternity leave, and then they have a kindergarten on every street corner. So, kids are taken care of, but we're not heading towards that system, right? We are America. We're a very, very different political economy and structure of our economy. And so we're not going to be going. So what are we going to do, right? Because you need to tell me about all the women who've just quit their jobs, in the last 2 years. I want you to solve that problem for them. Because if you really care, I'm putting you on the spot, sort of hypothetically, if you really care about women's rights and equality, you're for mass migration of nurses, caregivers, cleaning ladies, and cooks right now, like yesterday. Because I am, and I'm willing to say right now I am.
What if I'm for the child tax credit?
You can be for that, but it hasn't passed, right?
Which is more likely to pass an increase?
And actually, child by tax the way, during is already US law.
Yeah, and also during COVID, we spent millions and actually billions of dollars on payments to households. So it seems that the more realistic path politically is expansion of the welfare state versus mass migration, just in terms of the actual domestic politics of this. Like, which is more likely to get a filibuster or opposition from Kyrsten Sinema, welfare payments or migration, considering she's an Arizona senator?
Well, it depends if you think about how you categorize it, because you could actually do what other countries do, like Germany, where every person who's coming in, they say, look, what's your skill? Are you educated? What did you used to do? And even if you're an unskilled person, there's still a job for you. So if we had an organized system, even with the people waiting right now at the border, say, okay, you're a farmer, you're needed in that state, here's your document, here's your pass, play by the rules, stay in your lane, that kind of thing, it could be more tolerable. So there are ways to make, again, you don't want to hold all else equal, and you don't want to simply have a linear continuation of the confused and agreeably chaotic clearly chaotic past. So, it's sort of when you say what is more likely to pass, well, in what form? I don't think anyone wants to simply repeat chaos, right? But knowing again that we need these people, knowing that our policy is broken, ideally you come up with a system that's better and that is palatable.
I was interested in your point that some form of dealing with this is inevitable, because you brought up East Asian countries, but if you look at Japan, Korea, those are countries which have faced exactly the labor shortages and massive fertility declines. They make us look totally great, yet they have not pursued mass migration. So I think if you're looking at the thread of Sagar and my pushback, it basically comes down to, I feel as if you are treating certain policy choices as inevitable, when if you look across the industrialized world, they aren't making those same choices.
No, but that's not true, because in fact they are. I cited for you earlier, Canada, Germany, Great Britain. Again, it's easier today to migrate.
I brought up East Asia specifically because they have the combination of massive worker shortages, massive, massive fertility declines, and they also are notoriously anti-migrant.
Right.
Even compared to Italy,
there's a very, very, very easy sort of rejoinder to that question, which is, do you want to be like Japan? I mean, our last 10 years of economic strategy is always saying, we don't want to become like Japan. Japan is the poster child for what you don't want to be. So why would you want to cite them as a role model? So here's the interesting thing. So I think that's sort of, you know, an important rhetorical point there. So what that Japan has been like this? That's precisely why the path you don't want to go down. But now, by Japanese standards, I have a whole chapter on Japan in the book. They have, you know, opened up like never before. There are physically today 3 million non-Japanese people living in Japan. Obviously, that's not happened in 7,000 years of Japanese history. So it's pretty remarkable. And those people are, and I kind of actually give this sort of passage in the book where I kind of give the journey of a Filipino migrant to Japan. You start out being recruited for elderly care, but then your employer obviously eventually passes away, but you're still in the country because then there's a shortage of nurses at the hospital. So you go work at the hospital. But then an expat family has come in because the Japanese government has liberalized the, you know, purchase of properties to foreigners. So you get permanent residency when you buy a home. And those families, that American family that's come in, has kids. So now you become a nanny for their kids. So you've spent like 15 years in Japan as a Filipino. You're effectively a permanent, you know, resident. And they are actually creating these tiers and categories for precisely these people. There was a story in the Nikkei just a few months ago. They're opening the first Muslim cemetery in Japan. Like, what? Right? It's because they're Bangladeshi workers, construction workers that have been there so long that they're not really ever going back to Bangladesh. Like, their home is Japan, and the government has realized that. So I've looked specifically line by line at the immigration policy of Japan, and believe it or not, by Japanese standards, it's a radical opening. But again, still, it's not nearly enough. It's way too late. So you don't want to be like Japan because they've had this last decade. And you don't want to be Japan because, to the extent to which they're doing this at all, it's way, way, way too late.
I'm curious where culture comes into this. I mean, you gave Germany as an example. I mean, in Germany, yeah, you can be an immigrant, but like, ask the Turks there. Like, they don't think they're German, and Germans don't think they're German either. If you look at Australia, pardon?
No, I mean, let's say we can take multiple examples. These are all very good examples. And look, there are, again, there is no sugarcoating that there is sort of culture wars going on, you know, in Australia, absolutely. And it's become geopolitical, as if there wasn't enough of the jealousy and concern about, I don't want to say cultural dilution, because it's ridiculous to posit cultural dilution in Australia on the basis of a not so large, you know, Chinese population. But, you know, rising home prices because they're rich foreign investors coming in and all that kind of stuff. There's tension, right, overall. But if you look at, this is a perfect case study, though, the demographic change of Asians overall, especially in the next generation, is so significant that it's already way past the point of no return. It's like America since the 1970s, 80s, 90s, right? Even under the most, again, you know, racist, nationalist, whatever you want to call him, president, you didn't really make a dent in the continuous path towards diversity. And Australia is way down that path. Canada is way down that path. Canada is more, you know, becoming more brown than white, or will be in like 10 or 15 years. So it's like, okay, so, you know, it reaches the point where you may continue to have this backlash and these movements that are cultural, nativist, and that have some legitimate and some illegitimate concerns. You may have them forever. And they may form their own party, their own political party that will have a continuous voice, as has been the case in Germany, right? With the NPD party in the 90s, the AfD party today. But just ask yourself which parties won, which force won, which outcome prevailed in a mathematical sense. And the answer is ultimately more diversity, more migration, more attempts at assimilation. And that's where Germany comes in, because I think that the way you described it is now a kind of 1990s view. Because I went to high school in Germany. It's my home, or my second home, if you will, especially Berlin. I've been going to Germany for 30 years since the wall came down and lived there multiple times. And when I was literally a high school kid in Germany, outside of Hamburg, I was definitely the only person of a certain complexion, right, in a quite significant radius. And if you had told the, what's his name? Jürgen Rüttgers or something. He's a German politician who coined the phrase Kinder statt Inder, like, you know, have more children, don't import Indians, right? Yeah. If you said to him in the year 1993, 1994, it's like, hey, I got some news for you. In 30 years, your country is going to have 1 million Africans, about 6 million Turks, about 2 million Arabs, and, you know, X number of people from the former Soviet Union, all of these people from the Balkans, 500,000 Chinese people and about 80,000 Indians. He would laugh in your face, right? He'd say, what kind of dystopian novel, you know, have you just scripted for me, for my country? Well, welcome to Germany in the year 2021. Right? The same country that just threw the AfD party out on its ear, right? Zero presence in federal politics to speak of, right? That's Germany. And they have a very sophisticated discourse about identity today, right? It's called Die Neuen Deutschen, the new Germans. And this discourse does not posit that you must become like us. There is a fixed German identity, and I'll tell you what it is, and you are measured in your Germanness by to what extent you hew to that. That's not the way. It's really about what is it going to mean to be a German? What are going to be our standards and norms and mores in the year 2025, 2030? And what is everyone's contribution to it? And, you know, that civic identity rather than ethnic identity is becoming the mainstream approach to the issue in Germany. So I want to hold them up and Canada, you know, as examples of very, you know, large, extremely important Western societies that are immigrant societies that, especially in the case of Germany, do not have a history of thinking like that. It's a lot easier for us and for Canada to think in this way, a lot harder for Germany. So give them some credit. And it clearly shows that even in one of the most difficult political environments and again, historically, you know, in terms of historical ethnography and politics environments, it can absolutely be done. And they're doing it right now.
You know, it's interesting. I'm basically this podcast's house neoliberal. So when I say that I am in favor of immigration, and when I say that I like diversity, when I say that I'm confident in our ability to come together as a country 30, 40 years from now as demographics continue to change, I really believe that. But at the same time, where I get off board with you, and I think a lot of people who, once again, are not racist, operational or otherwise, is they probably blanch, and I blanch, at the implication that the 4 to 5 million people who are in Mexico right now should essentially be let in because they made it to the border. And hypothetically, we could have this hyper technocratic process where we say, you're a farmer, you're a home health aide, you're an electrician, you're an architect. We need people in Detroit. We need someone in Toledo. We need someone in Pittsburgh. I'm just not confident that process exists. And as someone who's from a state, you know, the state of Oregon, where we have a population of around 4 to 5 million people, I am just skeptical of the idea that one is, it's fair to catalog someone who hears that 4 to 5 million number. I'm just like, whoa, I don't think that's racist to like oppose that. I don't think it's racist to say, hey, like, I actually straight up do not trust the US government to adjudicate the fair, I mean, it's a perfect example. And then I'll let you go on this, because once again, like, I appreciate your ability to take pushback. I really mean that, because oftentimes people don't. But, you know, look at the discourse on globalization the past 30 years. I'm pro globalization. To a certain degree, these things are inevitable with the rise of the internet and communications. But how many times did we just push aside concerns by saying, oh, don't worry, we'll have worker retraining programs. Oh, don't worry, we'll do this technocratic fix, or we'll do that technocratic fix, or, oh, we'll teach people how to code. We'll do all these little things that sound good when we are talking decently eloquently about, but don't actually exist. So I think it's the combination of, whoa, like the population of the US state could come here, and then just being skeptical of a dilapidated government's ability to actually fairly technocratically assign and manage those dynamics. So I'm just curious how you think about that frame.
Look, I mean, we could obviously spend hours outdoing each other in bashing the incompetence of the US government to administer or adjudicate anything. So I'm not going to second guess anything you said, and not even facetiously on the cultural side. I do hear you on that too. Remember that the reason that the AfD party in Germany did get wiped out is precisely because Merkel shut down the immigration in 2016, right? So that's very important. She wouldn't have gotten reelected if she hadn't cut the migration from a million something down to 30,000 something, right? So that's what happened. So in democratic politics, you know, you have to make those compromises. So I'm not saying that that, you know, 4 million people should be let in overnight. I did not say that, right? I'm saying that those people are there and Mexico can't handle it. We do need to do something. We do need to feel not only morally obligated to do something, not for all of them and not for all of them at once, and maybe sharing the burden with Canada, maybe sending a lot of them back. And that also constitutes doing something, right? To think of what the solution is. And the solution, to the extent it does require technocratic thinking and planning, I mean, you know, maybe call that my cardinal sin, but I'm a big believer in technocracy. I wrote a book with the word in its title. And I happen to think that just because the mere fact that you rightly point out that this seems just implausibly out of reach, given today's institutional arrangements, is the saddest statement and condemnation of all. And sadly, I can't disagree with it. But that doesn't mean that it's not possible, because it's precisely what Canada does, and they're not very far away. So it's not like it's another planet. Canada does that, and Germany does that, and to some degree, Britain also actually does it. And there is, you know, sort of free market approach to these things like we are. You kind of show up, and once you're there, well, you find your own way. And they generally tend to be like that, by the way, for reasons that are quite similar to us, which is that because there is already such an incredible amount of diversity in the country, the ethnic groups tend to absorb their own as they come in, and they don't even need to necessarily have a state-based government filtered approach. In America, it would be relatively similar, of course, because obviously there's no nationality not represented in the US. So again, I'm still not making the case. It's a scenario, right? I'm not making the case that 4 million people come in tomorrow, right? I'm absolutely not making the case. I'm saying, let's make a list of things that we should do. And some of them are technocratic, some of them, but that doesn't mean it's not in our interest. You know, if you were to depoliticize certain things and say, fact, we need people, you know, fact, we need them in XYZ areas. Fact, these people are standing here right now and waiting and they're not going back. Fact, it's going to be really bad for Mexico if we don't do something now. You might get a little bit of room for maneuver to do some sensible things and wave that wand. That's what I would do. Right. But and maybe you would do it too, because you agree in the overall with the goals. I don't take seriously arguments of cultural dilution, right, which is not one you're making. But because I make, you know, a case in the book that, you know, you cannot treat or should not treat identity as some immutable concept that's ridiculous. Right. It's the identity that doesn't evolve is doomed. So I think that it's part of our story to come up with a solution and be the leader in coming up with a solution to this.
Last big question before Sagar pivots us to Asia. Points for anyone who noticed the Obama 2012 policy reference. In terms of your broader work on Asia and its rise to finding the 21st century, what does it mean to be a citizen in the 21st century you're describing? Because the part that's also interesting here is another part of me, and like we saw in a large portion of the audience that really blanches, is this idea that we should think of citizens as essentially economic widgets that we're shifting around. So what? So like, let's say you're the Filipino person who moves to Japan for work and stays there, but is a permanent resident. What does it mean if you are a Turkish guest worker who comes to Germany in the 70s and is still there? What does it mean if you are one of these undocumented migrants who's trying to get into the US? Like, what is, just define what citizenship means, given, once again, this is where we agree, these structural factors that are pushing on the political system, whichever direction people want to go.
Right. And I think this notion of citizenship is becoming more expansive, you know, because we tend to think now that once you are a legal resident in the country, there's much less concern over whether you're a citizen or a non-citizen. It's, are you legal or illegal? You know, I no one knows when I became a U.S. citizen. It just happened when I was a mid-teenager, but nothing really changed. We had green cards from the time we moved to America, you know, for 8 years afterwards. And it was just, you know, par for the course. No one treated me differently the next day. And in many countries today, what's happening, and this is again where Canada is interesting, they're creating very clear tiers, you know, that are again very transparent. And it's a ladder that you can earn your way up, which is to say, okay, I came in as a, you know, a category whatever worker in this profession, and I was given 5 years. And if I have a good track record and don't break any laws, I move up to the next level. And in that next level, I'm allowed certain privileges. I get to own my own business. I don't have to be an employee anymore. At the next level, I'll actually get to start to vote in local elections, but not federal elections, which is happening all over Europe, by the way. And, you know, in the UK as well, you can vote even when you're not a citizen. This was a factor in Brexit, actually, because there were so many foreigners who voted in Brexit who were not actually citizens of the UK, because that's actually part of their law. And this is very common nowadays, especially at the city level, which matters a lot. So if you're a legal resident, so everything but, in most countries, voting in the federal elections and the right to hold office, you more or less have those guarantees and rights and privileges even as a non-citizen. So having more transparent tiers is an extraordinarily important way to get around the very kind of, you know, dramatic binary, you know, sort of notion of your question, which is, are you a citizen or you're not a citizen? It's like, you know what, I have this status. And it's like, oh, cool, right? You know, because it's legal, which is something that you're rightly emphasizing. And you know, in a state with a rule of law, one should rightly emphasize, right? You know, are you legally here? Did you earn your way here? You know, and you know, are you, you know, have you broken any laws? Are you a resident in good standing? This kind of thing. And again, how is that impossible? You know, I can name you 12 countries that are our peers, peer group nations that have implemented those policies years ago or are in the process of doing so now. Surely we can do that. And that would also go a long way towards depoliticizing the situation.
Yeah, I mean, I want to make sure that we can talk a little bit about Asia, something that we've been really fascinated. We've been talking a lot about here, and actually has been coming to dominate American politics of late, which is just, regardless how you feel about China, the Obama, you know, administration's entire policy was a quote unquote pivot to Asia, get out of these Middle Eastern wars, focus on the Asia Pacific, where the rising economies, China, all of that is happening. Actually, something I completely agree with in principle, if not necessarily execution. You wrote a book, The Future is Asian. Do you see that thesis embedded within what you're talking about here? Where do you think Asian dynamism and the U.S. context, all of that comes together in the year 2021?
Well, I mean, the future is Asian, irrespective of whether or not a U.S. administration gets Asia policy right or not, right? In the sense that it's the seat of demographic and economic gravity. You know, it's kind of where the future is being built in terms of infrastructure spending and a lot of technological innovation and on and on and on. You know, trade intensity within Asia exceeds Asia's trade with the rest of the world. So Asia is building its own system, as I call it. A system does not mean a peaceful system, by the way. In international relations theory, there's no connection between the word system and the notion of peace. A system is defined by the intensity of relations between its units, and that can often mean war. Europe has been a warlike system, a violent system for thousands of years up until the last 75 years, for example, despite its cultural, relative cultural homogeneity. So Asia can be violent. It can have the next five world wars could be in Asia. And it'll still be an intense system that's defining, you know, sort of what the kind of the global scene and having its imprint on the global scene. It doesn't mean that we're in absolute decline, only relative decline, which is perfectly natural given where the United States was in 1945. But I'm saying all of this because to be relevant in the world means to be relevant in Asia. If you're not relevant in Asia, you're not actually global. You're not a global power if you're not relevant in Asia, because Asia is where most of the humankind actually is. So my point is now, what does this mean for the US as it approaches Asia? Is it relevant or not relevant? Or rather, let's measure the ways in which it is relevant. Militarily, check, extraordinarily relevant, right? Playing a central role in working with Japan, well, of course, on its own, irrespective of whether or not free-riding allies have gotten on board or not. But now with Japan, with India, with Australia, with the UK, and of course with Korea and the Philippines and others, working to strengthen other Asian powers so there can be a collective security, collective defense set of mechanisms. I use the word allies, and I should not use that word because the word alliance does not really have a strong meaning in Asia compared to Western history. But a coalition, for sure, many coalitions that are seeking to ensure that China does not achieve regional hegemony in Asia. And I do believe that we will succeed, right? We will succeed, which is to say all of us, not America, all of us together will succeed in that world historically, geopolitically significant objective of establishing and maintaining geopolitical equilibrium on the Eurasian landmass in general and in Asia in particular. So that's important. But that doesn't mean that, you know, it comes at a great cost, obviously, that exertion globally on the military stage. And of course, as we well know, and many people have rightly criticized, from Obama through Trump through Biden, it's not good enough because it's not coupled with the right economic strategy. Our trade policy actually encourages American companies to offshore, which is the exact opposite of what the middle class oriented pro-growth, you know, industrial policy leaning foreign policy of the Biden administration has been. Because when you're not party to trade agreements, your companies are disadvantaged on the other side of the world. So your companies have to go and relocate and set up local operations there to get behind the border. And that's what American companies are doing one after the other after the other. So if you don't join the TPP trade agreement, your companies are increasing their relevance in Asia because they're investing in creating jobs in Asia. But they're no longer really American companies. They're not repatriating their profits, right? So you have to couple it with the economic strategy, and there has to be obviously many other components to the engagement in Asia. But I think that, you know, sort of rumors of America's disengagement or demise from Asia were massively overstated prior to the pivot to Asia. The notion of the pivot gave the impression that America was ignoring China, and we weren't ignoring China. That's ridiculous, right? And even though you could even wrap a nice ribbon around Afghanistan and Iraq and say, you know, okay, Biden really wanted to get out of that and, you know, continue on this mission to focus on Asia. The fact is that America is still a superpower and is capable of juggling its priorities and obligations in all of these theaters at the same time. And that's what we're doing. And a rebalancing within that is necessary and good. But so I want to give partial credit, you know, it's like the pivot to Asia is, you know, as much as the term has actually fallen out of favor in Washington itself, we remember it kind of nostalgically in the way that Marshall just used it, or as a trivia question, which was actually the way in which you used it. Let me give you the example. The former U.S. ambassador here in Singapore, where I live, is a good friend, Kirk Wagger. And when he went on TV once and he was asked exactly about this pivot to Asia, he came into this country exactly when the pivot was being announced. And you know what he said? He said, let me quote LL Cool J. He said, don't call it a comeback. We've been here for years. and he's absolutely right, because I was here before him and I've been traveling in this region for more than 20 years. And, you know, it's like a lot of the other issues we were talking about. The gap between perception and rhetoric and the political discourse amongst, you know, people in the sort of chattering class who aren't looking at what's happening on the ground and that ground reality is like night and day.
So I think we'll get two or three last questions in here. And this goes to, I didn't finish, but I started reading the book and you talk about this a bit, but my immediate question is, what is an Asian country? Because under certain frameworks, you could probably argue the U.S. as a Pacific power, as a country that has territory, Guam, Micronesia, Hawaii, a large East Asian population in itself, and South Asian, actually in many ways is an Asian Pacific power. So you also have
don't confuse Asian and Pacific, right? I mean, just because we have this hyphenated term for Asian Pacific Islanders or whatever it is in the category that I fall into in America, I'm very clear about this, you know, given my obsession with geography, as you can see on the wall behind me. We are a Pacific power, but not an Asian power. And those are obviously two different things.
What's the difference?
So an Asian power is not only obviously either a continental, you know, Asian state located on the landmass or the eastern two-thirds of Eurasia, or of course an immediate, you know, sort of geological proximity to it, like a Japan or Indonesia, but obviously also historically and culturally has been a participant in this Asian system throughout history and previous instances of it, whether it's demographic or whether it's geopolitical, maritime, commercial, and so on. And so it's not a wishy-washy question, what is an Asian state? And I you know, begin the book with a very important geography lesson, which is that actually no two geographers on Earth dispute what the notion of Asian is. So I find it really entertaining when people say, well, what is Asian, or that's not Asian, or, you know, Iran, that's not Asia, right? Asia is only Greater China. It's like everyone gets to have their own definition of Asia. It's like, no, you don't, actually, because it's a geographical term. So only a geographer gets to define Asia. It's not a matter of opinion. It never was, and it never will be or shouldn't be. And Asia stretches from Mediterranean. So Israel is an Asian country. The Mediterranean Sea marks the border of Asia. The Greek historian Herodotus to him it is attributed to have coined the word Asia to refer to the Persian civilization that was across the sea. The Gulf countries, Turkey, you know, those are all Asia. Most of Russia is Asia, right? So there's a very clear geographical delineation of what is Asia. And part of my argument was that again, the systemness of those countries. So what, they share a geography. It's like lots of 53 African countries share a geography. You know, therefore they are all African, but to what extent is Africa a system? And the answer is Africa is barely a system at all, right? It doesn't hang together other than geologically. But if you look at Asia, the systemness is incredibly intense, right? It's approaching European levels of trade intensity. They have their own diplomatic institutions, Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and all of this stuff. The Asians travel within Asia triple the rate that they travel outside of Asia. Foreign investment, technology, you name it, you know, student flows, Netflix, Korean drama consumption, you pick the metric, Asia is becoming more Asian. It's a measurable proposition in day-to-day life, as well as a geological, you know, geographical fact.
My last question here is, what will be the U.S. role in that system? Because to your earlier point about the 20th century and Europe, part of the reason why for the first time in 1,000 years, the Western European landmass is peaceful is because the U.S. very concertedly placed itself in the middle of that. The NATO alliance, nuclear weapons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, hobbling Germany, putting away Prussia for once after the 1945 period. That was this very direct period, role that we play in stability. And the U.S. faces a lot of questions around, like, hey, how far does Europe go? Like, what's our involvement in Ukraine? How far does NATO expand, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When it comes to Asia and the different types of potential conflicts that you're referencing, what role will the U.S. play as an outside the system actor, right? In the sense that it's not an Asian power, as you just delineated. But we have troops in South Korea. We have troops in Japan, obviously. We just started, there are reports that we've just started placing special forces trainers in Taiwan. So we actually have a very deep entanglement there. What role will we play there? And is the U.S. a stabilizing or destabilizing power in this Asian century as you're talking about this system, which is a great framework?
There's a lot of scenarios as to where this could go. So when you ask the question of what role will the U.S. play, I mean, that I cannot answer. What role could it play, and how might it play out? Because, you know, for every action, there's a reaction, you know, in Asia itself. But overall, there's no question that given that China has kind of, you know, come unhinged in terms of its nationalism and aggression and so forth, you know, there's no doubt that, I mean, there's the fact is, I don't think China will ever regain the trust of any of its neighbors, which is not to be mistaken for those countries still moving ahead and signing, you know, huge agreements like the RCEP trade agreement with Asia. They'll do that because it's their neighbor and it's the largest economy in the region. And it benefits them in terms of boosting exports into that country. So, but don't mistake the gravity of China with trust, you know, for China, because I don't think any such trust exists. I don't think it ever will exist. I think that Western countries have been far more duped by China than any Asian country, because Asians actually live near China and have a long history with China, know very well what China's ambitions are, and have absolutely never had any doubt as to where the virus came from, while this was still being debated somehow in op-ed pages around the world, like, did it really come from China? You'll never find an Asian who didn't know with full confidence where the virus came from, right? Because they kind of know China. So do take their word for it. And so if they're telling us that they're very concerned about China, that's an open invitation for America to stay in the region. And Europe, you know, is making ever more, you know, sort of verbal and you know, actually making good on certain promises of strengthening its commitment militarily, commercially, investment, trade agreements with Asian countries. So I think there will be a strong Western presence overall. The military component of that will be dominated by the United States. Here's the crucial thing in answering your question. There are about 8 or 9 major conflict scenarios in Asia, right? That many. All of the significant conflict flashpoints on Earth are in Asia. The rest are not significant. I mean, Russia and Ukraine is not going to become World War III. It's just not, right? But India and Pakistan, India and China, China and Japan, South China Sea, North Korea, Taiwan, any one of those, you know, could become World War III. So the U.S. is going to have some either direct or adjacent role in any one of those scenarios, right? It's almost impossible to imagine otherwise. But whether or not that's going to be positive, negative, you know, whether we're going to be a decisive role or suffer a humiliating defeat, that remains to be seen, right? And I can't predict, but I can, you know, generate scenarios about each of these situations. But here's the most important thing to remember is that unlike Europe 100 years ago, there are not, again, automatic alliance effects and escalation dominoes in Asia, because unlike Europe, none of these conflicts is actually connected to the other, even with China simultaneously being a participant in all of them or a protagonist or antagonist in all of them. It doesn't mean that they're actually connected, because they're not. Each of them, I did a long essay about this for the National Interest, and I called it the technocratic piece. So there we go again, a technocracy. Yeah. I was saying, look, every one of these conflicts has a completely distinct origin. Many of them are pre-colonial, and they date back literally to unsettled, you know, disputes that modern international law can't adjudicate because the parties don't recognize the lines as they were set in 1945, because these are pre-colonial disputes, right? So you have to treat them all one by one, and the parties involved treat them one by one. So if you had a war in the South China Sea, it doesn't mean that suddenly that winds up leading to a war between China and Japan, or that India and Pakistan blow up and that kind of thing. So treat these one by one in an isolated way. And that obviously serves our interest. You do not want these conflicts being connected. You do not want our military having to handle 6 contingencies in Asia at the same time. If war were to break out, God forbid, whether it's Taiwan or South China Sea, you want that to be as absolutely geographically ring-fenced and contained and isolated as possible, no matter who wins or loses, right? And the good news is that's the way the Asians look at it too, because when two parties in Asia fight, the third and fourth countries tend to say, well, let's just see how it shakes out. You know, we'll be friends with both when the dust settles anyway.
Well, you know, that's actually a good note.
Way. Yeah. That's the Asian way.
That's the Asian way. I like it. Parag, we've been very generous with your time. We really appreciate you joining us. This has been a fascinating discussion. We're going to have a link down in the description for people to buy both the books that we mentioned. Anywhere else you want to direct people to?
Nope, that's fine for now.
Great. All right. Thanks. We really appreciate you stopping by.
Thank you, guys. It's pretty fun.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.